talking about several things, but the theme of this is actually testing gravity, or at least searching for interactions that essentially modify the 1 over r squared of gravity at different scales, and I said at extreme scales, because I want to concentrate on those two regions here. So what I'm showing here is the distance scale in meters here, and conveniently in astronomical units on the bottom side. This is kind of weird. Okay, and the strength of the interaction for a Yukawa correction. So this is lambda in the Yukawa term, and this is alpha, the strength of the.
I'd like to remind you that this graph that Eric plotted.
Yes. Is missing your piece.
Missing my piece.
Yes, and in fact, that's why I'm very careful at attributing it. This is actually, but you're right, I didn't know about your result. We'll add it, but anyway, but we're innocent. This is actually Eric's fault. So anyway, but nevertheless, I just wanted to, I think it's kind of interesting to explain a little bit of this before moving on, right? So this is the lab scale that is missing your deep thing around a meter or 10 meters or something of that sort, around the meter scale. So there is a nose sticking down here. It goes somewhere here. It's kind of interesting to see the different regions here. This is actually by far the best known region, in a sense, in terms of how small an interaction can be that has not escaped our detection. And that is done with lunar ranging. And that takes advantage of the fact that the moon goes around very frequently, and so we have many, many cycles. I mean, Eric can tell us more about this, but I think that's you know, the thing is that you need, having something very large and heavy, or you know, massive, is not perturbed by other interactions, and is a periodic motion that is fast enough that you can see many, many cycles. This region here is taken care of artificial satellites. In fact, probably you can even see geostationary satellites and other types of lower orbit satellites here. This is the region that where finding oil and finding deviations from gravity is kind of a degenerate problem, so you don't do very well because you don't know the composition of the Earth very well. And then this is the lab region where we said there is actually this, there is something missing here. As you move farther away, planetary motion doesn't help you very much anymore for various reasons. First of all, actually one thing that is very sensitive to actually look at the precession of the perihelion, and if the orbit of something is very circular, you know, you don't have very good sensitivity to that, so that's a problem for some planets. And then, of course, by the time you get to the distance of Jupiter and so on, we haven't existed as a physics community long enough to actually see many periods of the orbit. Okay, so we run out of steam both in this regime and in this regime here. And by the way, like 10, 20 years ago, there was this Pioneer anomaly that would have been truly revolutionary because, in fact, was contradicting the data from the solar system, you know, the dynamics in general. All right, so I'm going to spend the first 10 minutes talking about, or maybe 15 minutes talking about the far right, that is the very large distance scale, and then spend the rest of the time where we have data, or we're trying to take data that is at short distance scale. And of course, the short distance scale part is dovetails well with Andy's talk from yesterday, at least the first half of his talk of yesterday. All right, so now why it's interesting to actually go a large distance? Well, you know, it's kind of, in my opinion, at least as an experimentalist, I like doing like making measurements about very fundamental things and checking whether gravity works at all distances or works as it's expected to work at large distances, and all distances is kind of an important thing in general. I should point out that if you go back here, you know, this graph here, of course, relies on the correction to be a Yukawa, of a Yukawa type. And of course, you have plenty of sensitivity all the way here at, say, 100 astronomical units. But this, of course, this slope here relies very much on the Yukawa model of this other interaction or this new interaction. And so there are other models in which, you know, unless you really go there and do the measurement, measure the acceleration from the sun, you really don't know what's going on. Okay, so now in general also, and I know, you know, some theorists here, in fact, some I'm sure plenty of theorists will shake their heads, but on the other hand, you know, there is dark matter. We don't know what dark matter really is. And then there's even dark energy. We don't know what dark energy is. Well, who knows? I mean, I know that you know, we haven't figured out a way of modifying gravity that actually accounts for everything and so on. But still, it is not unreasonable to actually try to go check gravity at those as large as possible sort of scale. Okay. So, all right. So what's the challenge? Well, the main challenge, of course, is getting there. Okay, this is very far, and the idea would be to say, how far away can we actually measure 1 over r squared with a real experiment that qualifies as a lab experiment, not just doing astrophysics, essentially. So that's actually getting there is very hard. You need essentially a light payload, the fastest possible rocket, and then you need to actually have some gravitational assist from other planets in order to actually slingshot as fast as you can. You want to do this in the time scale of, let's say, 2 graduate student generations or something, not 10. I mean, that's unreasonable. If it's like 5 or 10 years, it's still OK. 100 years is not good enough. So it turns out that as we looked into this, the Pioneer spacecrafts, as you can see, they were not doing very well. And of course, that was because this was not really what they were intended for. And so those things were leaky. They were leaking all sorts of stuff. They were leaking fuel. They were leaking alphas from their radioisotope generator and all sorts of things. And so you actually, when you start looking at this, you see that very quickly that you cannot do this measurement with a conventional spacecraft. In other words, unlike the moon that is very heavy, very massive, and it doesn't, it's not easily perturbed by things that are not gravity, anything that is actually made by us is too small and too light to actually be a real inertial body. And so you need to essentially simulate this with a drag-free spacecraft. So that's a spacecraft where the inertial object is contained inside a cavity. And then you essentially servo the spacecraft to follow that object that is inside. And so this is essentially like the way LISA is working and other missions of this type. Okay. So now it turns out though that even doing the drag-free mission, you still or spacecraft, you still have it's still not good enough. And the main problem at that point is that if you are slightly offset, if your shell, if you want, let me call it shell, the rest of the spacecraft is not perfectly centered around the proof mass, it gives you a gravitational, gives the proof mass an acceleration directed in one direction all the time. And so that is very similar to the kind of effect you would see, the kind of correction you would like to actually detect. So at least we'll see that maybe there's other ways around. But for the time being, in the work we've done on this, we've actually assumed that the spacecraft is essentially tumbling in a plane that contains the sun. That way, if you have a force, an anomalous force generated within the system, it becomes like a sine wave with the period of this rotation of the spacecraft. And you can easily fit it out. Okay. You also need good quality telemetry. So that is the S function of time. You want to measure the position very accurately that you do by ranging and the velocity. But it turns out that the ranging measurement is actually the dominant. So I mean, this is the more accurate one. So this is where your error comes from. So you want to do that well. Now that is actually, those two things are sort of contradicting each other. You see, when you're at 100 astronomical units away, you want to have a big high gain antenna in microwaves or a telescope with a laser ranging system pointing down to Earth. But now I just told you that you want this thing to tumble around. So you can actually, again, if you do the little bit of math, you can easily convince yourself that this is just inconsistent or incompatible. So at least in our initial design, you need actually a formation flight of 2 spacecrafts. You have the spacecraft that does the measurement that is tumbling. And then this thing has essentially a cell phone and talks to a relay spacecraft that is maybe 10 kilometers away, so far enough that it doesn't perturb the motion of the first thing. And this is actually pointing down to Earth with an antenna. So you do this telemetry in sort of two shots. And then I'm told it's very hard to build those things reliable over very, you know, very long sort of lifetime. Although the pioneers and the voyagers are still up there and doing fine. But anyway, so but the idea is that you have to build a drag-free system, including its micro thrusters, with a reliability that allows it to operate for like 10 years. All right, so that's actually, these are the parameters we sort of came up with. I should really say that, you know, none of the people doing this have any experience really in spacecraft design. And so this is very, very preliminary. This is good enough to get through the review of PRD. It's pretty obvious that it's not good enough to really, design this thing. But this is just a way to get started. So we just essentially assume that the object, the payload itself, I mean, this thing here, you can see the proof mass and the object and the shell rotating around, and then there is a relay craft here, and then there is down the center of the solar system. So the mission duration to go to 100 AU is 7 years. This is not done doing very sophisticated celestial mechanics, but essentially looking at some launch windows that are published in various places, or in various obscure journals for us, at least. And so this is not unreasonable, as far as I can tell. The proof mass is about 1 kilogram. You can read all the parameters here. These are all pretty reasonable. The red numbers are the ones that are, you know, that require some attention. There is actually the issue that those microthrusters, there's no, as far as I understand, space-certified microthruster with a with a guaranteed sort of endurance or whatever lifetime of 10 years. So this is something that is supposedly somewhat tricky. And then one thing that is really difficult is how to power this thing. Typically, there is a radioisotope generator on those objects. It is probably tricky to put it on this thing, particularly if you want to balance the masses very carefully. Those things usually are sitting on booms far away from the center of the spacecraft, so that makes it.
I'm sorry. Maybe you So there are God-given terrestrial satellites.
There are what, sorry?
God created terrestrial satellites like the Moon, Jupiter, and all these other planets.
Yes.
So why do you have to make another artificial terrestrial satellite? Can't we just the observation of...
Well, I mean, that was the first graph, right? I mean, the limit you see there comes from studying the motion of Mars, Jupiter, and so on and so forth.
So you're trying to go beyond that.
Yeah, you want to go beyond that. Yeah,
so
I mean...
So you're probably Pioneer. But Pioneer reported anomalies, so...
Yeah, but that was wrong.
They basically claimed that the inverse model has been violated. I mean,
right, but that was wrong. That was fine to be wrong.
Yes. But, so what you plotted was there... Positive result you plotted, not the negative result.
Okay, so this is the Pioneer anomaly that is now discredited, and I'm just showing it here for historical reasons.
Okay.
And then this is the limit that you get from essentially studying the motion of planets in the solar system.
So you're saying that you can do better than...
Yeah, just patience. We'll get there. All right, so I'm just telling you how this is supposed to work, roughly, and then I'll show you how well it's, you know, we expect it to work. Okay, but now to those 7 years, what happens in those 7 years? Essentially, spend about the first 2 years orbiting around inner solar system bodies and picking up speed, and then there is and during this time, by the way, you need real rockets to actually do maneuvers and stuff, which are not the microthrusters. So the idea is that this is kind of a relatively sophisticated thing with three stages, if you want. And they fly together, including the propulsion stage, for a couple of years. And then after the last gravitational assist, and I'll tell you a little bit that this is kind of an exotic gravitational assist, you actually detach the propulsion stage so you don't risk all your rockets leaking fuel to actually ruin your measurement. And then the two things detach. One is the beacon that talks to the Earth, and the other one is the thing doing the measurement. And they coast away only following the proof mass at that point. Okay. Let's see. That's what
is the proof mass sensing?
The proof must what, sorry?
The sensing deadband.
Oh, this is not entirely. I think there is several things. This is probably, so it turns out you want to build a large cavity for the proof mass. You know, the GPB had a very tiny gap. This makes it really hard. And GPB was, I think, capacitively sensed. For something that large, I think it's an optical readout. You have an optical readout between the proof mass and the shell. OK, so the dominant systematics, you build a system like this. The dominant systematic actually turns out to be the mass and density distribution of solar system objects that are not very well understood, and in particular, Cooper belt. Cooper's belt, we don't know the mass very well, and we don't know the mass distribution and the thickness of the belt and all that. So it turns out that in order to minimize this uncertainty, that is the dominant one, you want to go out in a polar trajectory. That's why I said it's kind of a funny gravitational assist. So the last slingshot, you want to go, say, under the sun, so to speak, and be shot sort of towards one of the two poles. So that makes it kind of a bizarre mission, because it not only goes very far, but goes in a direction where no one wants to go, because there's no other object. You know, that's the whole point. You want to have only the gravity from the sun as much as possible. As a byproduct, not that anybody cares, but you'll measure the mass or GM of Cooper belt to 5 × 10⁻⁴, which is kind of much better than we know it now. And so you'll actually essentially map the gravity in the solar system in other objects in the solar system very well. But the idea is that in the fit, this will look different enough that you'll be able to actually disentangle it. And the other dominant systematic is the ranging accuracy. So that's it. So if you think you can do the proof mass deal as well as you think you can do it, then you are left with those two things. And so we will show the sensitivity next plot, or the next couple of plots, for 1 meter ranging accuracy, which I think everybody claims is at this point, believe it or not, conservative. I find this amazing, actually, that you can measure things 100 AU away with 1 meter accuracy, but they claim this is actually totally standard. And this essentially uses a microwave transponder and DSN. When we wrote the paper about a year ago, we also assumed an aggressive sort of sensitivity that comes from actually doing ranging at 10 centimeters. It turns out that this is done with laser ranging. People at JPL. You need to have a transponder. Oh, you need to have a transponder, no doubt. Okay. When you are that far, there's no, okay?
I'm just worried about your sphere.
Yeah, no. There is definitely a transponder. Let's see. But by now, I'm told that aggressive should be a centimeter, and I don't have a plot for that, but you can sort of guess it yourself, assuming that people down at JPL know what they're talking about. Actually, one thing I didn't mention, when I was interrupted by one of the many screen changes and stuff, I said that the radioisotope generator is kind of tricky. So one thing that is a possibility would be to actually put the radioisotope generator on the beacon spacecraft and then essentially shine a laser to the payload and use that to power the payload. That actually doesn't need that much power. So this is not entirely sort of crazy. All right. So, to give you an idea, those parameters that I have here are generally much easier to reach than, say, LISA. LISA is a similar system, but it's much higher performance than this, except this has to fly 10 years very far away. And that's where it's really tricky, as far as I understand again. All right. So then this is actually that curve that I showed at the beginning, just the detail between 0.1 and 1,000 astronomical units. And with the uncertainties coming from the initial conditions of the measurement, and then what happens when you add the uncertainty in the Cooper belt mass and Cooper belt shape. And so that's actually the curve you're left with at the end. And now I can actually overlay, and that was for a meter accuracy in the ranging. And so that is this curve here, the blue curve. You can see this little bump. Has to do with essentially Cooper's belt anomaly, if you want, or uncertainty from that. And then if I had, and this is the existing limit, and the pioneer anomaly is way up here. Okay, so you can do a couple of orders of magnitude better with this 1 meter ranging, with 10 centimeter ranging, maybe you can do 1,000 times better. And of course, if you can really do 1 centimeter ranging, well, you can do even better. But as I say, that's not been calculated. So just as a to conclude this, I don't want to spend too much time on it because this is a little bit maybe crazy. But so we will hopefully start in September a study with JPL. Turns out that JPL has been craving to find a reason to go very far. Their engineers really want to go very far, but there's no real science. And so there was actually a very nice match when we told them about this. I said, oh, that sounds really cool. So we should actually try to develop. So we'll have maybe a slightly better developed thing where you know, some experts who know about this, they'll help us actually inject some realism in this kind of thing. The two things that may be improving in this is, first, I already told you this issue about ranging. They also think that they actually have a way to go in about 10 years to 500 AU. That may, you know, may be even better. This involves some scary flybys. You have to go really close to something. So, but you know, no one is up there. So, okay, maybe that's okay. Anyway, so I think in a year we'll have hopefully the result of this study, which will be sort of fun. All right. So now let me switch gear and go to the other extreme of the range of distances. And so that's actually something that was introduced very well by Andy yesterday. So I think I can actually probably go a little bit fast here. Of course, the issue when you go to, in some sense, the small distance regime, actually in every sense, is more popular, or at least there is more theory that actually supports the interest to actually do measurements there. And of course, the challenge is that, you know, as the distance becomes smaller, your proof masses become smaller, and so that scales with the third power of each of the two radii or the distances essentially. And so in the end, as you get closer and closer, this force becomes smaller and smaller. Even if you think you're measuring acceleration, the acceleration scales with r. And so as the range becomes smaller, the acceleration is smaller and smaller. And then, of course, the other piece, which is equally daunting, maybe even more scary, is the fact that, of course, when you get very, very close, even neutral objects have electromagnetic interactions of one sort or another. And so one has to be really careful about background. And I think it is fair to say that many of us are both very excited by the idea of actually seeing a signal, but also really scared about what we would do if we would actually were to see a signal. And I tell my student, you know, Alex, you know, if you see something, it's going to be a long PhD before you convince everybody, at least you know, convince ourselves at least that this is something that is real. All right, and so that's actually this regime here. Let me go fast on this. Okay. Yes. Oh, sorry.
For your scaling law, that's for the point particles, between two point particles.
Yes.
But if you use surfaces, you don't lose that.
Yeah, if you use surfaces, it's different. That's right. Yes. If you use surfaces, I'm going to sort of now deprecate surfaces here, but you're right. The scaling can be different if you actually, yes. So, okay, so now where we're going towards point-like particles. And this is a matter of, I think this is good if the community is actually more than one of those things, because each of us knows he or she is right, but we all know that everybody's right. But we always have doubts. But anyway, this is our rationale, is that, well, you know, if you're measuring something a very short distance, you should really have something which has the size comparable to what you're measuring, because otherwise there's all sorts of other issues. And here I'm showing actually the Edvorsch torsion balance that has been the dominant force in all these things at short distance for many years, and it's a real amazing feat in experimental physics, I think. But having said this, there are a number of so this is Eric will tell us about this in a couple of days, I think, right? But this is essentially something the size of a soda can, okay? And so among other things, you know, and so essentially what you're measuring is the gravity between those disks or the gravity or the anti-gravity between the holes of the disks or whatever. But you essentially, if you want to go down to 50 microns or 10 microns, you have to essentially, among other things, make the two disks parallel to each other or coplanar to that very high accuracy. And I'm claiming that this is kind of something you don't really need to, you shouldn't really worry need to worry about. And so having a small particle, in some sense, is sort of the ideal thing. So the sensor of the force in this case is similar to the range of interest. And of course, we'll be doing this with levitated microspheres, which is a way to replace the mechanical spring that is the torsion fiber or the little cantilever in the case of the older, I mean, of actually Andesthesis and Aaron Kapitulnik's group. Again, those are all mechanical springs, and the idea is to replace that with optical springs that have a number of advantages, including the fact that you can even modulate the spring force in a way that is instantaneous with respect to the behavior of the system and so on. Now, I just cannot resist sort of telling you how this started, at least for me, and with a frustrated attempt when Peter Feerlinger, where's Peter? He's not, okay, there. When Peter Feerlinger was in my group to actually see whether one can do this with neutrons. And somehow I've never been able to actually figure out how to do it with neutrons. Now, of course, neutrons have a charge radius which is much smaller than that of an atom or of a microsphere. And so all of the issues about of electromagnetic interactions go away or at least become much, much less issues. Except we couldn't figure out how to do it with neutrons. And so I figured, what's next? The next smaller thing from a neutron, well, you know, a little microsphere. And so actually that's how this thing came up, came up in our group. If somebody has a way of doing it with neutrons, I think that's, I would change immediately and actually go work with neutrons. But I don't know how to do that. And the reason, by the way, is that neutrons don't exist. That's my theorem. But that's true, right? I mean, the thing is that what you'd like to do, you have the pencil beam of neutrons and essentially shoot it next to some attractor. But when you go to very small distance, in order for this to be meaningful, your pencil beam has to have a finite number of neutrons in this very small cross-section. And it just with cold neutrons or ultra cold neutrons, you essentially throw away all of your neutrons and there's no neutrons left, which is that's just a different way of saying that neutrons don't exist. So we're stuck with microspheres. So now in high vacuum, you can actually cool the microspheres. So let's see, most of this stuff was said by Andy. So let me just tell you what the difference is. So Andy's using a trap with counter-propagating beams. We use a trap with a single beam that is propagating upwards, and it has a focus, and the microsphere is essentially confined to moving just above the focus of the beam, and the same. And so this is actually the radiation pressure from the bottom is countering the uninteresting Earth gravity, and then the focusing is essentially providing an attractive potential for the middle of the beam, and so that your microsphere is suspended in there and is confined to actually moving near the axis of the beam, and is bouncing up and down into this spring that is the light coming up. Okay, so let's see if there is actually so. I will show you data and other things with 5 micron diameter spheres. You can actually get dielectric spheres between at least 10 nanometers and 10 microns or 15 microns commercially. They're even cheap. They're mostly used in biology to actually manipulate DNA, like with optical tweezers and so on. And in fact, this is essentially an optical tweezer setup, except it's in vacuum as opposed to in water. That is what biologists usually do. Actually, the first work on this was done by Askin at Bell Labs many, many years ago, and this was the beginning of optical tweezers. And so some of those techniques actually just come straight from there, of course, much improved with time. Okay, so first of all, I added a few slides on microspheres because yesterday there were questions, and so this is actually sort of fun in general to see. Of course, the microsphere is stuck at the end of it. So, you know, the way you deliver the microspheres is actually with a diving board made out of quartz in our case. The microspheres are essentially spread on the bottom of this thing, and this is connected to a piezoelectric transducer, and you just shake this thing violently, and this thing sort of snow down into the trap. And if you position this thing properly, occasionally one will be caught by the trap. You want to do this in some residual gas. I was about to say air, but in fact we use nitrogen because we have all sorts of fears about humidity in air, and so we use dry nitrogen. Whether this is really important or not, we are not sure, but anyway. So now when you do this, by the way, you snow for our trap, where the beam comes from the bottom, you have the final focus lens looking up in the vacuum chamber. And so you end up coating your lens with all sorts of, you're sandblasting your lens, which is not good. And so actually, our system at least, has a catcher that is another quartz plate, blade at the bottom. And this diving board, the delivery sort of gadget, and the catcher are on the same stage. And once we have a sphere in there, we retract this thing. And in fact, the lens now actually stays clean, and this thing gets all the microspheres on it. The amazing thing is that this is actually far away from the focus, and you can move this thing out without losing the microsphere, which is something that was not obvious that you can actually do this. And when as the edge of this thing goes through the beam, that you don't disturb it enough to actually lose the microsphere, but that works reliably. So that's a picture of our spheres. Now our spheres tend to be larger than Andy's spheres. And in fact, we are really optimized to do a measurement somewhat with better alpha and larger lambda, and Andes group is working more into the smaller lambda and larger alpha. And so we have larger microspheres. For the time being, we're using 5-micron diameter spheres, but eventually we'll be doing measurements probably 10 or 15 micron spheres. Those being larger, they are less difficult to actually throw off the cantilever, or the diving board than Andy's. I don't think we've broken some of those things shaking them too much, but very occasionally. It is not very common. And presumably, if you make them sapphire, then you can shake them more without breaking them. So since somebody was asking how reliable is the diameter of those things, this is actually, we've done some work. In fact, we had an undergraduate this summer doing some work on this. This is a SEM picture of a bunch of those five micron microspheres. And let's see. This is actually the radius of those things. That is half of 5 microns, a little bit short of that. So this is nominally, they're supposed to be 2.5 micron diameter. They're more like 2.4 micron diameter. But you can see that the sigma of this distribution is quite narrow. It's about 1%. The two graphs are for quartz microspheres, or no, silica microspheres, and metallized silica microspheres. The SEM has a stage where you can metallize things. And the idea was to see whether there's a systematic effect and whether you... You just evaporate some, I don't even know exactly whether it's gold or something on them.
On the surface.
On the surface. The problem is that when you put in the SEM, you use an electron beam to actually scan this thing. Yeah. And if it's a dielectric, you never know whether there are some, you charge them up and then the electron get repelled. Mm-hmm. And then maybe the size you measure or the image you get is not quite right because the electrons get sort of... So oftentimes you metallize your surface and the microscope as a stage where you can actually add some...
How much do you care if the sphericity? How much?
Well, okay, so that's they are spherical to within... The eccentricity is within 5%. Okay, whatever that, so that's the number.
Yeah.
Those are spheres that are actually grown in a solution. Dave may, and by the way, this is half of this work is done at Yale by Dave's group, and the other half is with my group. Let's see, Dave may know something more about how they grow this thing, but this is, as Andy said, it's kind of half of secret. Some of it is published, some of it is not. You buy them from this company called, you buy from many places, but there is a particular place where we bought those things. I think they found a place in Germany where you can also buy those things that maybe is a little bit better. That's more reliable, more consistent, the dimensions. But anyway, it is not entirely clear to us how the density of those things is somewhat lower than the density of fused silica. It's not, again, this has to do with how those things are grown, and we don't know much about this. At least I don't know much about it. I should say that you can, so okay, so whether or not you metallize it, you see the apparent radius is about the same within what we care about. So this is sort of good enough. You can buy those things out of many things. So you can buy fused silica. This is a case where essentially you spray like sand in an arc in vacuum, and this thing bolts up, and then you get bolts this way. This only works for larger size. If you go to very small size like the ones Andy's using, I think this technique here is pretty much the only thing available. The ones that are made in this arc are less consistent in terms of size, although we never measure them ourselves. I think you get, in that case, you get really all sorts of sizes, and then you use a sieve to actually select a particular size. But as I say, we haven't really tried with that. Presumably, those have more the density of the bulk material, but I don't know. You can get titanium oxide, zirconium oxide, sapphire, and various plastics. In fact, the plastic ones, and I'm just saying this because there might be other applications and other ideas. The plastic ones, since they're used by biologists, come also functionalized. That is, they have various interesting groups attached to the edge, you know, like COOH or NH2, and other little sort of snippets of molecules attached to the ends. This may be interesting if we, for instance, if you want to spin them around or do other things with them. They have a deliberate asymmetry in the thing. I should say that most of them, I mean, this is kind of a typical picture. It's not selected in any particular way. But sometimes there are spheres which are kind of stuck together. And when you load those in the trap, you can definitely tell. You know, they make all sorts of flashing. You know, they behave very differently. They're wild. And you usually just throw them away and start over. So there are occasionally things that are like dumbbells and so on. So the way our trap works, and at least this is actually some sort of Mark I version. I'll show you later the more recent improvement. But we use a 1064 nanometer laser that is actually a very standard laser. And essentially, okay, so there are two lenses that make the final focus of the system, where you, and then you position you drop your sphere somewhere up here. And then the second lens is used to actually essentially provide the imaging system for the two horizontal degrees of freedom. And this is imaged in a quadrant photodiode that is used to actually provide the feedback into the laser position to actually cool down the center of mass degrees of freedom of the microsphere. At least in the data I'll show you, the trap had an auxiliary laser that happened to be a red laser on the horizontal, in the horizontal plane, to actually image the vertical position and feedback on the power of the laser to keep the sphere at the right height. By now we're doing this differently, so I'll show you a little bit more about this laser later. Okay, I think that's pretty much it. So you drop the microsphere as a futor of nitrogen, and then you start pumping down the chamber, and you do it somewhat carefully so that as you pump down the chamber, you also turn on the feedback, and you start cooling the sphere. If you don't do that, you lose the sphere. Having said this, I think our experience with these larger spheres is substantially more benign than Andy's. That is, we never had particular problems in losing the microspheres when you pump down. I mean, if you do things reasonably, it just works, essentially. And then, of course, you go down to, I don't know, maybe 10 to minus 5 or 10 to minus 6 torr. That is where we're doing the measurements at present. So you can see here the cooling. All right, let me actually go fast on this and things. So you actually can routinely obtain something between 10 and 100 millikelvin temperature for the center of mass degrees of freedom of the microsphere. So many people asked yesterday during the talk and later at dinner and so on, what happens to the internal degrees of freedom of the microsphere? And I think at least our first, you know, we don't quite know. I mean, we're not very, we've never done the work of actually measuring the temperature of the sphere, of the internal degrees of freedom of the sphere. It would also be interesting to know what kind of coupling you get between those internal degrees of freedom and the center of mass. I suspect the coupling is small, but we don't have real data.
When you melt the sphere?
There's actually some, so we this is actually definitely don't melt those spheres.
I mean, it depends on how much power you charge.
Well, it depends on what kind of dissipation there is in the microsphere, right?
Yeah.
So I think with the quartz, so this is actually one reason why we never tried plastic microspheres, because I'm just afraid of making a mess. But I don't know. I mean, this is actually
no, because it may tell you something about why is the discrepancy in the density, right? If there is,
yeah, we talked about this. You can explode. Okay, so you can actually heat them up and try to remelt them and so on. Yeah, we haven't really.
So what about the charge?
So the first issue is to drop the microsphere, catch them. This is kind of, at this point, trivial. So the next question, existential question for this thing is, well, what about the charge of the microspheres? If they're charged, then you can't do the measurement or, whatever. So,
what's
that? Yeah, you asked, that's what I said. This is actually exactly the right time. So, so that's the next few slides are about charge control. You can see that at least one of those traps, I'm mixing up a little bit, there are different generations of traps, different generations of lasers, and I'm mixing this up a little bit in the interest of time. I'm not going historically, really. But one important thing is to make sure that you have an easily controllable equipotential surface around the microsphere. And in particular, in the early times, we discovered that the lenses tend to charge up. And in fact, if you don't have any way of screening the potential from the surface of the lenses from the microsphere or the microsphere from the surface of the lenses, you get all sorts of problems. And in fact, actually, we can infer the charge on those lenses. And this is a charge that is very consistent with some of the charging up that LIGO has seen on their mirrors. In fact, we've been corresponding with LIGO about this, and within factors of 2 or 3 is the same number. So, quartz objects charge up in vacuum in a consistent way, in a sense. So the way we solve this this issue is to, you could coat the lenses with indium tin oxide. That somewhat makes the AR coating less easy. And so in the end, what we have is that we have essentially funnels in front of the lenses, metallic funnels. And those essentially hug the beam that is focused in here. And then there are little holes that are like a few millimeter diameter from where the beam comes through. And so that now you attenuate the electric field coming from the lenses in the trapping region. And so you can see it here. In fact, this is actually a trap or D-trap with the top piece removed, so you can actually see down there, and a little microsphere in there, and you can sort of see through this thing. This is actually illuminated by the red laser when we had an auxiliary red laser to do the vertical degree of freedom. Now you wouldn't see anything like this because it's all infrared, but in any case, that's the way, that's what this thing looks like. So this is an idea of how well you're shielding. So if you have 10 volts on your lens here, then this is all, now this is the a map of the field, or the absolute value of the field in various regions. And so you see on the other side of the funnel, you are here if you zoom in. And now if we have a cantilever sticking in, that is something that is your gravitational force source, you can see that you have vastly attenuated the electric field in there. Now it's really very uniform in there. So now let's see why that's important. And to do this, I'm going to skip one step back and talk about some early measurements having to do with electrostatic charges directly. So this is an earlier version, which is kind of equivalent to this. But in this case, there's only two electrodes on the two sides of the microsphere. But you can do the same thing with two. So actually, those electrodes here are all floating. Those little things are ceramic-like wafers. So each of the 6 electrodes can actually be biased independently. And so when you do that, you can apply an RF, an alternating field, and actually see the microsphere move when you apply the electric field. This, by the way, is essential because that's a way to calibrate your force sensitivity. Okay, and sure enough, when you drop your microspheres, they are charged. They can be charged with like hundreds of charges. And then you flash a UV light in there that comes in from a flash lamp through an optical fiber in the vacuum system. And you can see that eventually you get down to 2 quanta of electricity, 2 electron charge, 1 electron charge, and then 0. And then if you keep flashing, you can actually charge it the other way around. But just to show you how good this is, at this point, you can essentially stop here. increase your, so when you have a few charges, of course, if you have too much RF voltage, eventually you drop the thing out of the trap and so on, so you have to keep the thing reasonably small. But by the time you get down to zero charge, well, you know, this is zero, so you should be able to have infinite field and nothing happens to it. And so you can actually boost your field up. In this case, as a 500 volt amplitude, the signal you're bringing in there. And we observe it for a couple of hours. And now you can actually see how zero, you know, how neutral is a neutral object really is. And you can see here that you have essentially the you can measure with very good accuracy the position of this peak and the width of this distribution if you want there. Okay?
That distribution is just the measurement accuracy.
That is essentially fluctuation in, well, I mean, that's some convolution of, in fact, we want to interpret this thing as what if there is a small fractional charge on the sphere.
Yep.
Sorry, can you see the polarizability?
We're getting there, just one thing at a time. So this was actually something that, so this was actually something that, let's see, there's a paper, yeah, this is actually a PRL paper a couple of years ago. 3 years ago, time flies, and actually, and so this is essentially, you can interpret this as a measurement of fractional charges, or in fact what they call millicharges, because we're talking about not just fractional like 1/3 or 2/3, but really small. And in fact, this is actually, you can express this, so first of all, you can see that there is, of course, there's always a residual response, if you want. And this is actually shown here in units of 10 to the minus 6 of an electron. This is a millionth of the electron charge for a relatively microscopic object. And you see that this is the direction of your electric field going back and forth. And you see that, in fact, in the most part, those things move orthogonal or in some random direction to the electric field. That's actually what this funny polar graph is supposed to actually show you. This is the strength of the movement, you know, of the equivalent response of the microsphere, and this error bar is an indication of how well you're measuring the angle in which this thing is moving. Okay, and this is done for, there's a bunch of data points because there's about 10 microspheres that were actually used to do this measurement one after the other. And so now you can essentially interpret, so actually we are very conservative. You could say, well, you know, none of these things is really consistent with the sphere moving this way, but we still take the strength of this motion as and disregard the fact that it's moving in the wrong direction and use that to actually calculate a limit on those, you know, on existence of those millicharged particles onto the microspheres. And so you see here, this is actually our limit. And these are the past limits. Those are essentially searches for free quarks. And you see how this is optimized. When you search for free quarks, you have a sensitivity which is only to like 10% of an electron charge or something. But you want to process lots of material because, well, you know, because then you actually can look at smaller concentrations of free quarks. And this was actually, Kim et al. Is actually the best limit that is essentially Marty Perl's group using an inkjet printer kind of nozzle to actually deliver lots of little droplets. His droplets are larger, and he shoots lots of droplets through his system. We use many, you know, about 10 microspheres, and we observe for a very long time with this kind of fancier system. And so we go much deeper, like 10 to the minus 4 charge size, but we're not very sensitive in the sense that we don't process enough material to be competitive in that direction with them. So Dave's group at Yale is actually continuing this work on charge, and in particular, improving this measurement, and sorry, this is just a historical, I just want to concentrate on this thing. In particular, extend this thing to measure neutrality of matter, that is, check to what accuracy the proton and the electron charge, absolute value of proton and electron charge is the same. In order to do this, you want to essentially optimize to have larger microspheres, because now you're not looking for a fractional charge deposited on that thing, but you're looking for a small difference between the very many electrons and the very many protons. So you want to have as many protons and electrons as possible. One of the better measurements, or actually maybe the dominant measurement done on this, was actually done by my friend in Italy with a very clever system that I just can't resist showing here. So they essentially have a sphere filled with some gas, that is neutral, and then you apply a big RF, a big again, voltage to this thing, and then you have microphones. And the idea is that if this RF makes the gas slosh in there, it will make a noise that you can hear with this thing. I have to say, I'm not convinced that they calibrate this properly.
How do you calibrate?
Yeah, that's right. It's done theoretically. That is, they calculate the modes of this thing and so on, which I find somewhat objectionable. But anyway, that's the how well they know that the this quantity to a part in 10 to the to any one of the electron charge. And as actually, these are slides from a postdoc in Dave's group. If you actually put together, so in the last several years, there's been many, many years, there's been very little progress in this area, and so it's important to actually try to do this measurement. Dave's trap is very similar to ours. In fact, I shouldn't. The only thing is that they use two colors because they want to outdo us and have something more cute. But anyway, they use both the 1064 and a double beam to do the measurement. But otherwise, as I say, it's very similar, except they use larger spheres, and they have a system optimized with two plates where they can apply this voltage on a stage and so on. And so they can apply something like 10 to the 6 volt per meter to do this measurement. You can see, again, the discharging of microspheres in that system. And they have a sensitivity that, in a day of measurement, should get them down to 10 to the minus 21 electrons. And this is the way, actually, if you look on the left-hand side, this is neutrality of matter. This is the current limit from the Italian group. This is a sign, right? So this is proton plus electron charge with sign. So this is the positive sign. This is the negative charge, the negative sign. And you can see that their projected sensitivity is down here, which should be at least an order of magnitude better. This is shown against the neutron charge that also comes from this measurement, as well as from direct measurements of neutron charge that is done, I believe, in a beam line, right? Peter, you were talking about this. Still talking about electromagnetic measurement, one can, and since yesterday there were a number of talks about hidden photons, you can also do a measurement of hidden photons by essentially applying a voltage through a screen, through a shield, an AC voltage, and actually trying to, detecting a possible motion due to a force which goes through the screen, essentially. And so this would be the sensitivity, the ultimate sensitivity they would have. This is a more, a measurement that they can do, in a short time scale as a function of photon mass and coupling. This coupling chi here, or dark photon mass. All right, so now let me go back to things which are more the taste of gravity. And so along the way, so how does the gravity measurement work? Well, in fact, maybe I should sort of go back and forth a few slides. OK, so this, by the way, is a picture of our trap, which is very pretty. You can see those funnels or cones actually sitting in front of the lenses. The lenses are in those cells inside here. So now the measurement of gravity will be done by bringing near the sphere a patterned attractor that looks like a diving board or a cantilever, and then swinging it in a way to expose different density materials. But in the meantime, as we were setting things up or making some progress with the setup, we decided to make a measurement that was somewhat simpler because it doesn't have to confront Eric's best numbers or measurements, and that is to actually look for screened scalars, that is, these chameleons, for instance. And it's not obvious that the theoretical treatment of what we've done is exactly right. At least I think some of our colleagues don't agree with that. But anyway, let's just treat this as a entirely phenomenological thing. So essentially, I take my diving board, and I bring it closer and further away from the little microsphere. There are some interactions, or one could imagine interactions, that are screened by matter itself. And so this is like measuring gravity, except that we found a clever way of making all of Eric's measurement invalid or insufficient, because his bulky device would screen the interaction, and so he would not be sensitive to this. I mean, this is kind of unfair, I think. There is always a way, you know, theorists always find a way of getting around your measurements, spend so much time with measurements, they say, oh, no, but, you know, too much matter or something else. Okay, so, but anyway, it was easy for us to actually do this measurement. But the thing is that since all of these things are at this point not valid, I can be pretty, you know, I don't need to be very good at doing the measurement and still be able to publish something. That's essentially the idea. So the idea is, so now you move this cantilever in and out, or actually here, and then you see if there is any response to this. Now, of course, when you do that, you have to be careful not only now, and this actually addresses your other question, or somebody's question about polarization. There is actually, even if the quartz sphere is neutral, the question is, does it have a charge imbalance? You can call it patch potential or polarization or whatever, but some, you know, or electric dipole moment. And in fact, you can have two components to this. You can have a permanent dipole moment. This is a real charge imbalance that is just stuck on the sphere. Or, and then there is a term that is the induced dipole, that is to say, the polarizability of the sphere. Those two things scale differently with distance. And so you can see, well, okay, so you can see two scalings for the kind of distances we're talking about here, which are between a few and 100 microns. So how do you deal with this? Well, what you can do is that you can take your cantilever that, of course, for the chameleon interaction or gravitational interaction has to be neutral, and deliberately applying a potential to it. And so now you're exacerbating this kind of effect, and so you can actually measure it. And then you can undo it then you can actually use a neutral cantilever to do the measurement. And so this is actually what happens. This is this force in femtonewtons now as function of the distance. And you can see this goes from like 20 microns to like 200 microns or something of that sort. And so you can see that there is definitely an effect, and the effect scales with voltage, the way voltage on the cantilever, the way it, you know, you expect it to be if there is some permanent or induced dipole. And so you can now fit to the permanent and induced dipole. I should really point out that this is a very extreme thing. And you know, so to do the measurement of gravity, I'm going to have that thing patterned, and then if I have the microsphere here, I'm moving this like piano keyboard parallel to it. So that will minimize the number of. Here, I'm taking this thing and moving in and out from like like 10, 20 microns all the way up to infinite distance or very far away. So this is an extreme thing. It's quite impressive. You can actually get that close to this thing without even dropping the sphere. In fact, I can tell you that initially you just hit the sphere or do all sorts of horrible things and so on, right? But we've learned how to do this right.
And there is no, I guess this is related to this.
2 minutes? Oh, yeah, you guys are asking too many questions.
Yeah, that's fine. But it doesn't disturb the trap at all.
Well, I'll get to it, you know, just in the next 30 minutes. We'll see that. It's funny because I had much fewer slides than I usually have. But anyway, let's go quick. So, all right, so you can see this was done with three different microspheres. You can call them Bob, Alice, and something else if you want. And you can see that this is the permanent dipole moment on it. And this is the, and this is essentially the term that goes into the polarizability. You know, essentially, this is the thing, the polarizability. And you see that, in fact, this number is actually somewhat different from what should be the polarizability of bulk quartz should be. And we don't quite know why that is the case. And it's possible that this is this funny silica that is as different.
Can't you make your life easier and put a shield between the cantilever and...
Well, that's a very controversial thing, yes.
Okay.
I mean, we can talk about it. Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, yeah.
What would pure silica be?
I thought I had this. Ah, here. Epsilon. Okay, so. Dave, you remember
it's
this?
One in those units. It's normalized, so it should be one. So it's.
Yeah, it should be one. Yeah, okay.
But we're also measuring a small. The dipole dominates, so you're trying to extract a small effect from the induced dipole on top of that.
So the permanent dipole is what is really the main effect. And, you know,
that's
those two curves are not that different from each other. So it's kind of hard to tell them apart.
Get the induced dipole from the transient frequency, right?
You can actually do the induced Well, a different frequency. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yes. From the trap. Yes. So anyway, let me just. Sorry. I'm getting. So now you turn off the electric field, or you know, you ground your cantilever, and there is still a small effect, which is probably now contact potentials. And in fact, you can interpret this thing as a residual contact potential about 30 millivolts, which is completely reasonable for this kind of things. That's right. But again, being conservative, we just decided to take this entire effect and call it the chameleon effect, and then use that to set a limit, which, and this is actually for three, there is three of them because there's three microspheres, okay? And so that limit at that time was not the best, but was quite competitive with actually Holger's limit. And now they have a better measurement. This is actually an updated plot, so we are kind of up here. On the other hand, there are many ways of improving that measurement. And okay, now it's like a two-year-old measurement at this point, but or one-year-old measurement. So now let's go towards gravity. And sorry, I'm just I'll finish quickly. Somebody was asking about whether you disturb the trap when you go that close to the trap. And the answer is that, well, yeah, you need to have a really good mode for your laser beam going there. And so that's why I said that I'm mixing up a little bit different setups and so on, because we have entirely rebuilt the optics of this thing to have a substantially cleaner mode. And essentially, there's two things that we've, you know, the two ways we've gone about this. First of all, we just redesigned the optics much better. To have, you know, you need larger optic surfaces, you know, elements and just much more care in actually designing the optics. But equally important, we've built a system that is essentially an heterodyne system where you have a phase reference from your laser. We bought an expensive laser, a relatively expensive laser, and essentially interfere the wavefront from the laser, the reference wavefront from the laser, with the light detected that goes through the trap. That way, light that is scattered from some, you know, from your cantilever or from some other objects, comes in with the wrong phase and it's suppressed by the detection system. Also, the system reads out the vertical dimension or direction, you know, position of the trap interferometrically by essentially reading out the back reflected light from the reflection on the sphere surface. And interferometrically measure the height of the sphere, which is very convenient because also is absolutely calibrated. So now you actually, as you see the sphere move up and down, you measure it in number of fringes, and so you know exactly how much motion there is in the vertical dimension. You don't need to calibrate this any other way, essentially. Okay, so this is actually works really quite well, and so we're getting ready to actually do the first gravity measurement. The attractor in this case is similar to the one I showed you before, but is now patterned with alternating high and low density materials. And of course, the front surface is all gold-coated to try to have as uniform a potential as possible. For the time being, we're being simple-minded, and the high-density material is gold, and the low-density material is silicon, simply because it's very easy to, well, not very easy, it's very hard, but easier to make things with on a silicon wafer. Later on, maybe we want to go for something that has the closest possible electrical properties with different densities, so maybe silicon and copper. But of course, the manufacturing of this thing is substantially more difficult. So this is the way this thing looks like now. This is the trap that I showed you before already. And there is like a snout coming in from one of those things with the patterned attractor. And then this is on a stage that can move it back and forth this way. And as of a couple of weeks ago, we have actually the first attractor set that is not perfect, but is definitely good enough, microfabricated. And you can see that this thing has, so this is a larger silicon wafer on the back there. There is this cantilever region that you can, so from here is, okay, yeah, that you can see is about 10 micron thin. You want this thing to be very thin because you don't want to intercept the beam of the trap as much as possible, right? So this is like 10 micron thin. The fingers are 20 micron wide and spaced 20 microns from one another, at least the gold fingers. And the quality of this thing, this is the edge of the silicon here and so on is really very good at this point. And so you see that there is a thin layer of silicon in front, and then there is gold plating. The gold plating is being applied. It's just I'm not showing it here because otherwise you don't see anything anymore. Also, the beam quality has improved drastically respect to what we had before. This is actually the spot in the old system, the green points, and this is actually the new points and you know the new system. And at this point, you know the beam is really diffraction limited at the focal point. But more important is actually to cut down on those wings, which are definitely not part of the mode of the laser. This is sort of scattered light, essentially, goes around. And you know, if you go, say, 5 microns away, you have less than 0.5% of the power in that system. Let me go quickly here. You know, this is actually, somebody was asking, why don't you have a freestanding shield? That's the design of an attractor with a freestanding shield. I was saying it's controversial. You know, I actually am fighting a battle against everybody else not to have the freestanding shield.
Why?
But we'll see. Because it's more complicated. And I'm claiming that if you do right.
Why is it more complicated?
Well,
I mean,
it is more complicated.
I know there's a force of
and
can you explain a bit more why?
Yeah, but I mean, remember, this is not a magic thing, right? I mean, this thing has a skin depth. And if you, when you go very close, the thickness, I mean, you'll see the electrical properties behind the freestanding shield. It's just that it doesn't move. And so if there is some non-uniformity on the surface, it's good. Look, we'll do this too, probably. We'll have to see how we get there.
The shield has definite advantage to eliminate other forces, but you lose the full distance. If you have a shield,
that's true.
Right? I mean, you need clearances and stuff. But anyway, look, this is. I think we'll try all of those things.
We can have a little betting pool. Will you eventually get a shield?
Okay. Now, see, I'm everybody's against me. I mean, actually, we're also developing or thinking about something. In fact, our Chinese collaborators are maybe developing something like this, and maybe also Dave, a fluidic system where you have a little channel that has a, you know, like 10 micron little channel, and you actually have little droplets of something alternating, say, oil and mercury droplets that move inside there, pump by little pump. This has a shield, of course, that is sitting there. It's just the wall of the pipe. Again, we may want to try to do this with discrete components or integrated in a little fluidic chip. That's something that we are sort of considering. All right, so now
I
just...
I consider that a shield and not that.
What?
I would consider that a shield.
I was actually, I'm a great, well, wait a second, I'm a great... I actually started to talk about this before. So I'm not against, I'm against certain types of freestanding shields. So, okay. At least for the first generation of measurements. I'm not betting anything, I'm just... okay, so let's see. Residual force. So this is actually... let's see, so first of all, Casimir forces. So what we're showing here, actually, this is Dave's graph. But this is actually the differential Casimir force between different types of fingers as a function of the separation between attractors. This is this... thickness of the shielding layer plus the distance in vacuum, essentially, for different distance in vacuum, 0.2 microns and 2 microns. And sorry, this is kind of, there's many curves, it's a little bit confusing always. But, and this is for the contrast between aluminum and silicon. This is the continuous line, so it's this one and this one. And this is the contrast between the better match, that is aluminum and gold, and those are the dashed lines, okay? And so you can see that this is gravity itself. And so that you can see that, you know, if you're making measurements at a total distance of about 10 microns, which is where we are now, and with the current force sensitivity, we are somewhere here, and this is the pressure limited sensitivity down here. At 10 microns, you don't have to worry about Casimir forces, even for the clumsy attractor that we have now with silicon and gold. As you get closer and closer, this becomes more more of an issue. And in fact, this is kind of an interesting thing to measure per se. But and then the other thing is patch potentials. And I've been preaching that when we get small spheres, is actually there is this, of course, this dipole moment, this residual dipole moment. But generally, and actually Andy already showed this map that comes from somebody else's paper, you only have to worry about patch potentials on very small surfaces or regions. And in particular, this is the patch potential on gold. That will be the surface of my attractor set. This is amazing. With 50 slides, you guys are asking too many questions. Okay. Anyway, and again, you see this is 1 micron, 10 microns is here. So we don't think, this is actually a curve coming from this paper here for gold. So we don't think this is going to be a problem for the 10 micron measurement for the time being. Furthermore, you can imagine running different microsphere diameters, different distances, of course, and rotating the microsphere that will eventually make the average out issues on the microsphere itself. So let me just go to the final slide. So I'm just done, okay? Where is the sensitivity? So this is actually in the region we care about, between 1 micron and 100 microns. These are the various existing limits painted in yellow. And with the present background, we think very soon we'll be able to actually have a sensitivity that is this blue curve, which is somewhat better than others, but not much better than others. And then in the next 5 years, we're projecting being able to do this. And then the standard quantum limit is actually this curve here, the dashed curve there. Okay, and so that's what sort of asymptotically the technique will do in some time. So I don't want to.
May do.
Yes. No, but look, you have to be upbeat. Otherwise, if you're not slightly reckless in those things, you never get anything started because. So I just wanted to, don't worry about this. I mean, I think there's no point in going through these things one by one. But I think the idea is that there is actually, what I wanted to actually emphasize here in the conclusion is that there's lots of other applications there's got to be lots of other applications to those microspheres. I've showed some of the electromagnetic measurements that we already done. And that they will do. And then there's the gravitational thing. There might be other interesting things. And so it'd be nice if everybody here can think of other ways we can actually do this. And then finally, this is actually supported by NSF and Heising-Simons Foundation. And this is work in some complicated way done by both the Yale and the Stanford group. I tried coloring authors in different ways, but it got very complicated, so they're all black at this point. All right, thank you.
So I think I kind of missed something for when you have the neutral charge state and you're trying to measure whether there's some kind of fractional charge and you're applying a large field, you still have, as you mentioned, a polarizability. And I guess in the data, I mean, is it an issue of getting the quadratic curve out of the linear curve on that? Because I didn't quite see that.
So, sorry, I'm getting there. Right, so we suspect that the ones that are kind of in the wrong direction, that the residual motion you get on those things that doesn't go along this thing is some funny motion having to do with the little sphere moving into this.
Do you see the motion from the polarizability? Maybe.
I mean, we don't know what this is. That's what I'm saying. Since we don't know what this thing is, we just use the largest of those things to set that limit. If this is due to polarizability, which is likely but not proven, then of course the limit would be even better.
Yeah, so it moves in the direction of the gradient of the field, which is one sign.
Right.
Real. The other thing is that the induced dipole moves at twice the frequency, so you can use that as a check on your backgrounds. However, the permanent component from patch potentials or whatever you want to call it
is what you see in this plot.
Yeah, this is done at the right at the fundamental frequency of the RF.
And we see motion at 2F as well, so we know that there's backgrounds. There's gradients in the field in this setup.
So there's always a little bit of a danger when you don't quite understand where the signal is coming from, and you simply say, well, there's no physics up to that limit. If you don't understand where the signal is coming from, you could have an even bigger signal and you're subtracting some of it, right? If you don't quite have a good model.
This is the largest possible signal that we see, and so I think it's fair to put that as a limit.
If anything, this is conservative. We don't subtract anything.
So this is, okay, you have to be a little careful, right? So I would say if you're a real purist and doing measurements which are statistically dominated, if you want to really attribute some confidence level to some measurement, Then, of course, to just say, well, you know, I don't know what this is, but I'll just put a limit there. That, of course, means that your confidence level doesn't really, you know, doesn't have the statistical meaning of what you. But this is a statistical, but this is a systematical effect, right? So I think to just say that conservatively it cannot be smaller, cannot be larger than that. That's safe.
Great. Do you think we could just continue the discussion over coffee? And let's come back here at 12:05. And let's thank Giorgio again for all the meetings.